Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack. I'm Chris. I'm Tricia Beattie. Today I'll be reading from the June 17th issue of the Christian Science Monitor. In the limited time we have, I'll read from their section called One Week, which is a series of brief articles and commentary on the top stories of the past few days. Washington. Trump was convicted. A bigger verdict from U.S. voters now awaits. By Linda Feldman, staff writer. The new normal is settling in. Former President Donald Trump is now a convicted felon, pending appeal, after the May 30th verdict in the New York trial centering on hush money payments to a porn star. Supporters are rallying to his side, donating money, and raising loud objections to what many of them see as a rigged legal system. Meanwhile, Democrats who have long dreamed of seeing Mr. Trump behind bars, still improbable but not impossible, are cheering. Others, including President Joe Biden, are playing things more cautiously. Candidates in both parties running for other offices down ballot are also having to strategize around the new reality of a ticket topper convicted of 34 felonies. But in the Trump-Biden presidential rematch that's shaping up, there's at least one point both campaigns agree on: that the real verdict will come on Election Day, November 5th. And with 5 months to go, these days post-trial are a time for wariness, not easy assumptions about the impact of Mr. Trump's conviction, political analysts say. All of us who knew that there was no way Mr. Trump could be elected after the Access Hollywood video in 2016 are being a little cautious right now, says Dan Schnur, communications director for Republican Senator John McCain's 2000 presidential campaign, and now an independent. That video, in which Mr. Trump boasted crudely about grabbing women, was leaked a month before the 2016 election and appeared to doom the Republican nominee's chances of becoming president. Indeed, that November he lost the popular vote to Democrat Hillary Clinton, but won in the Electoral College. In the Real Clear Politics average of major polls taken in May, pre-conviction, Mr. Trump had a razor-thin lead over Mr. Biden. A day after poll by YouGov of more than 2,600 U.S. voters found that half of Republicans were even more likely to vote for Mr. Trump since the verdict. But the longer-term impact of the verdict on voter behavior remains to be seen. Plenty of polls taken pre-verdict showed a small slice of the GOP electorate unwilling to vote for Mr. Trump if he was convicted, or at least reconsidering support for him. But such polls can't simulate the real-world conditions of news coverage and the responses of public figures, including Mr. Trump, experts on polling say. On the day after the verdict, the former president spoke for over a half hour at Trump Tower in New York, calling the trial rigged and the judge who presided the devil. Mr. Trump also said he would appeal the conviction, which included a finding of guilt on 34 counts of falsifying business records over hush money payments to porn actor Stormy Daniels, with whom he allegedly had a sexual encounter. For more than 6 weeks, the trial required Mr. Trump to be present in the courtroom. Now he has more time to campaign, albeit with uncertainty about what a July 11th sentencing will bring. This means more opportunity to refresh public impressions and make his pitch for another term. For Democrats, the job now is to talk about the hush money case in the context of the other three criminal cases pending against Mr. Trump, says Karen Finney, a Democratic strategist. Those cases center on alleged mishandling of classified documents, his alleged effort to overturn the 2020 election, and a racketeering case in Georgia over his alleged attempt to overturn that state's 2020 election result. Is this someone you really want to trust your future to? she suggests as a campaign message. More broadly, Ms. Finney and others suggest Mr. Biden and the Democrats also need to focus on the issues that are at top of mind for many voters, such as the economy. Mr. Schnur, the former GOP strategist, notes that Mr. Biden has been struggling with elements of his base for months over issues such as the war in Gaza and climate change. The risk to Mr. Biden is that they don't vote or vote third party. Many of those disaffected progressives say that because Biden hasn't been as aggressive on their issues as they want, there's no real difference between the two candidates, says Mr. Schnur, a professor at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School of Communications. The question is whether the Biden campaign can use this verdict to convince the Democratic base that there is a real difference between him and Trump. Mr. Biden and his re-election campaign were reactive right after the verdict. The White House counsel's office said simply, "We respect the rule of law and have no additional comment." The Biden campaign fundraised off the verdict, sending emails stating that the only way to keep Mr. Trump out of office is at the ballot box. On May 31st, Mr. Biden himself commented on the Trump verdict for the first time, calling Mr. Trump's morning remarks unhinged. But another event the day after the trial brought home the challenge the president faces in holding the Democratic coalition together: the departure of Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia from the party ranks. Senator Manchin announced that he has re-registered as an independent, raising speculation he could run for governor or even re-election to the Senate under that banner. For some Republican candidates down ballot, the Trump conviction may prove a double-edged sword. In solid blue Maryland, popular former moderate GOP Governor Larry Hogan is running a competitive race for the Senate and needs to attract both pro-Trump Republicans and anti-Trump Democrats in November. As the verdict was about to be read, Mr. Hogan, a Trump critic, urged Americans to respect the verdict and the legal process. Not long after, senior Trump campaign advisor Chris LaCivita fired back, "You just ended your campaign." For other Republicans, the Trump conviction has produced a reported windfall in fundraising, as it did for Mr. Trump himself. On the morning after, the Trump campaign said it had raised $38.4 million following the verdict, much of it reportedly from first-time donors. Traffic to the fundraising site was so strong that it temporarily crashed, according to the campaign. In Arizona, Pinal County Sheriff Mark Lamb, who is running against former TV anchor and Trump loyalist Carrie Lake in the GOP primary for Senate, said his fundraising page crashed too. "It's not just Trump. People like myself are benefiting from the verdict," Sheriff Lamb said May 30th. "I just did a fundraiser tonight, and these folks were upset." Books. The thrill of writing a winning caption for The New Yorker. 8-time champion Lawrence Wood offers advice for putting your best joke forward. By Ann Stein, contributor. It's hard to win The New Yorker magazine's cartoon caption contest. If you enter, it's unlikely that your caption will be either a finalist or a winner. But that doesn't deter an average of 5,000 people nearly every week from submitting their ideas for the captionless drawing that appears in each issue. How hard is the contest? Film critic Roger Ebert entered 107 times before his 108th caption was deemed a winner. He entered 92 more times and didn't win before he died in April 2013. Other famous non-winners include former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, composer John Williams, actor and comedian Zach Galifianakis, and journalist Maureen Dowd. Then there's Chicago-based attorney Lawrence Wood. Wood has been a finalist 15 times and a winner 8 times. He's won it the most. He's the best at it. He's the GOAT, writes Bob Mankoff, former cartoon editor of The New Yorker, in his foreword to Wood's book. Your caption has been selected. More than anyone could possibly want to know about the New Yorker Cartoon Caption Contest. The rules of the contest are fairly simple, according to the magazine. We provide an original cartoon in need of a caption. You, the reader, can submit a caption for that week's contest. People ages 13 and older can submit one entry on the magazine's website or Instagram account. Readers rank those submissions. The New Yorker's cartoon department reviews the top vote-getters and narrows them down. Then readers pick the winner. There's no prize beyond the glory that goes with having your name and caption appear in the magazine. This is the 25th year of the caption contest. Wood not only explains its history, but also offers rules and tips for improving your entry. The book is illustrated with 175 New Yorker cartoons, with examples of winning and losing captions. He uses his own great and not-so-great captions to reinforce his advice. His first rule is pretty simple. Correctly identify the character who's delivering the line. Wood features a cartoon showing a man and a woman at a table drinking coffee. The man's head is obscured by a brick wall resting on his shoulders. Some of the top-ranked captions picked by readers included, "My ex-wife got most of the house," and "I'm not seeing anyone right now." But those didn't win, explains Wood, because the character with a visible mouth, in this case the woman, should deliver the line. The winning caption was, "Do you mind if I bounce something off you?" Rule number 2, make sure you know what's happening in the cartoon. Wood wrote a caption showing what he thought was a tray of scones being offered to a man and a woman by the Grim Reaper. The man, according to Wood's caption, says, "Fine, more for me." But the cartoon's artist drew lemons, not scones, and the winning caption was, "He says making lemonade is not an option." Other rules include some excellent writing basics. Don't just describe what's happening in the cartoon. Tell a story. Accept the premise of the cartoon, no matter how outlandish, but ensure that your caption makes sense within the parameters of this premise. Choose your words carefully. Eliminate unnecessary words. Many captions in the contest are similar, and an extra word or two can decide which captions make the cut. Note, not every caption is short. One cartoon in the book shows two cavemen chatting. The winning caption? "Something's just not right. Our air is clean. Our water is pure. We all get plenty of exercise. Everything we eat is organic and free range. And yet nobody lives past 30. Most humans enjoy cartoons and winning things, especially things that are statistically difficult to win, says Emma Allen, The New Yorker's current cartoon editor, about why the contest is so popular. And submitting is a bit like getting to throw an opening pitch at a baseball game. For a brief moment, you get to act like one of the pros, whether or not the ball goes anywhere near home plate. On Film by Ken Macon. Butterfly in the Sky. Burton soars in Reading Rainbow Dock. The PBS series remains a touchstone for generations of children. Butterfly in the Sky, a documentary about the iconic Reading Rainbow, opens with an elegance befitting that kaleidoscopic feat of nature. LeVar Burton, the host, is holding a copy of Amazing Grace by Mary Hoffman. It is fitting as Burton sits majestically in the middle of a library, his graying goatee pristinely trimmed. He is a black man, a fact that doesn't go unnoticed or underappreciated during this 90-minute blast from the past. For the kids like me watching LeVar, for those of us who look like me, it mattered that LeVar was a black man, offered Jason Reynolds, a young adult author whose commentary stole many scenes. Both of my parents encouraged me to read, but it was my dad whom I remember standing over me as I pored over the newspapers he read. When my parents went to their favorite soul food restaurant, the servers got a kick out of the 3-year-old who read the menu word for word. Let my parents tell it, that gift picked up the tab a few times. Reading Rainbow, which ran on PBS from 1983 until 2006, is just that, a prism after the proverbial rain. It was diverse, a celebration of humanity, regardless of race or age. It gave young people the freedom to speak during a time when children were encouraged to be seen and not heard. Burton remains the perfect conduit, a wise sage whose salt and pepper hair is the visualization of a beautiful juxtaposition. He displays the wisdom that comes with experience and combines it with the freshness of a man who harbors the heart of a child. He is Afrofuturism and the old way all at the same time. If not for his graying hair, Burton today and the man in the flashbacks would be virtually indistinguishable. His various incarnations are the stuff of documentaries. My dad had a paperback copy of Roots, which was translated into a TV miniseries that broke viewing records. Burton became a household name as Kunta Kinte. As a nearsighted kid who grew up during a less forgiving time of Family Matters and Steve Urkel, I longed to trade my glasses in for the cool visor that Burton wore as Geordi LaForge on Star Trek: The Next Generation. And yet Burton is no mere symbol. He is an actor, an activist. His defiance apparent in everything from how he wore his facial hair to his rebuke of legislators who sought to take federal funding from public TV shows like Reading Rainbow. The documentary, on which Whoopi Goldberg served as executive producer, describes how Burton pushed back against producers who were splitting hairs over how he wore his mustache. They asked him to shave it off. He refused. The idea from the brass was to foster uniformity. Burton prioritized authenticity. I've been told my whole life by society that there was something intrinsically wrong with me, or undeserving of me, because of the color of my skin, he said. And I think that made me especially recalcitrant to give in. This, among other reasons, was why it was so important for Burton to testify in defense of Reading Rainbow, and by extension, all of us. It's easy to read that as protecting black men, but no, I mean all of us. This is part of the mosaic that makes up civil rights. Black people putting themselves on the stand to secure the privileges of all. Ultimately, the documentary is more a triumph than a requiem. There's a sense of humanity that perseveres and goes beyond the warmness of nostalgia. Maybe it's watching the smiling kids who became loving adults, or the series founders speaking about familial ties that went beyond educational rhetoric. It reminded me of my own family, my community, the folks who believed in me since I was old enough to write my own book reports or read a menu. Reynolds spoke to that beautifully. Burton reading is awesome. But a lot of us read. So for me, turning him into a positive figure simply because he was promoting reading is dangerous because it assumes there weren't a lot of us reading, he said. Or there weren't a lot of black teachers who were doing the same thing, black librarians, black parents, black scholars, black coaches and counselors. That all existed. Really, what Burton was doing was saying, yeah, we're him too. So, now what? Science and nature. Landmark Vermont Climate Superfund law would make polluters pay for climate change. By Troy Aiden Sambajan and Stephanie Haynes, staff writers. Vermont last month became the first state in the United States to demand that oil and gas companies pay for the costly impacts of climate change, a move that many experts say could pave the way for similar legislation across the country. Taking many climate advocates by surprise, Republican Governor Phil Scott allowed passage of the new bipartisan Climate Superfund legislation, which lets Vermont's Department of Natural Resources recover costs from those fossil fuel companies responsible for more than 1 billion metric tons of greenhouse gas emissions in the state. The money would go toward climate change adaptation or resilience infrastructure. Although most experts, including lawmakers themselves, expect a slew of legal challenges to the legislation, many see it as a groundbreaking effort to use a polluters pay model to manage skyrocketing expenses hitting state and local governments because of climate change. From revamping stormwater systems to deal with saltwater incursion, to repairing bridges and roadways washed out from unusually heavy rainstorms, to building new seawalls to protect from stronger hurricanes, municipalities across the country are looking at massive financial outlays. States need this money, says Martin Lockman, law fellow at Columbia University's Sabin Center for Climate Change Law in New York. States are facing increasing risk of natural disasters. They're facing chronic pressures from their changing climate that are really going to stress their infrastructure, their economies. This is a creative attempt to place the costs of climate damage on the companies whose products produced it. The legislation will likely be challenged in court. The American Petroleum Institute, a lobbying group for the fossil fuel industry, has opposed the new law, saying that it is unconstitutional. This bill is nothing more than an unnecessary new fee on American energy that would only stall the innovative progress underway to accelerate low-carbon solutions while delivering the energy communities need, says Scott Lauerman, API spokesperson. The unique legislation expands the polluter pays principle, a central tenet of U.S. environmental law that essentially says polluters are responsible for cleaning up the messes they make. Congress passed the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act in 1980, a law commonly known as Superfund, to help force companies to cover the cost of hazardous waste removal and mitigation. The Climate Superfund concept expands on this, with the idea that carbon dioxide, a primary greenhouse gas responsible for human-caused climate change, is the pollutant. This stance is bolstered by a growing field of climate modeling that traces the line from carbon emitter to extreme weather events. This climate attribution science can say that a particular event was a certain percentage more likely because of a warming climate. The Vermont legislation uses the Carbon Majors database to populate sophisticated models to connect damages caused to greenhouse gas emissions. We're at the point where there is a very sound peer-reviewed methodology for connecting the dots between how much fossil fuel companies emitted into the atmosphere and what the economic costs of those emissions are on the ground here in Vermont, says Elena Mihaly, Vice President of Conservation and Law Foundation, Vermont. The Green Mountain State experienced catastrophic flash floods and flooded rivers last summer, which dealt more than $2.2 billion in damages, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Montpelier, Vermont, received a record-breaking 5.28 inches of rain, damaging thousands of homes and businesses. Some areas reported more than 8 inches of rain within 24 hours, causing extensive damage to communities as well as road and bridge infrastructure, and prompting hundreds of evacuations. According to the National Climate Assessment, extreme precipitation events have increased in the Northeast by 60% since the 1950s. For Vermonters, it's been a wake-up call. For a long time, people figured Vermont was a climate haven. But after last summer's flooding and then another flood in December, it really opened people's eyes to the reality that climate damages are here and now, says Ms. Mahaly. Nearly two-thirds, 64% of Vermonters, support the idea of requiring large oil and gas companies to pay a share of the cost for climate-resilient infrastructure projects, according to a poll by Data for Progress. Even with federal funding for disaster relief, the state and local municipalities are still paying tens of millions for repairs for last summer's damage. Justin Mankin, professor of climate variability at Dartmouth College, says last year's floods were the immediate catalyst for climate action in the state. "This isn't a problem for 2100, says Mr. Mankin, noting that 2023 was the hottest year on record. The impacts of warming are here now. That's a crucial change for social palatability for these types of legislation. California, Massachusetts, Maryland, and New York are considering similar legislation to establish climate resiliency funds. Under the Vermont law, the state treasurer would compile a report of the companies responsible for more than 1 billion tons of greenhouse gas pollution in the state. Those companies would then make payments calculated based on each corporation's emissions from 1995 to 2024. Vermont's Agency of Natural Resources would then allocate the funding for the Climate Superfund Cost Recovery Program Fund to enhance infrastructure and weatherproof public buildings and address the health impacts of climate change. Vermont still will need to pay for many other resiliency and adaptation projects, but proponents of the Climate Superfund see it as an additional, crucial revenue stream to help local communities prep for the worst. Vermont and Vermonters are resilient and will come together, says Ben Walsh of the Vermont Public Interest Research Group. But we're just asking too much of them if we're asking them to shoulder that burden on themselves, by themselves. That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the June 17th issue of the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Tricia Beattie. So long for now.